So anyway, welcome to day two, or is it day three of Travatars 2004? I guess I'm kind of cutting a ribbon on the second day. How is everybody doing?
Doing great.
Pretty good.
Information overload. The brain is filled with stuff, but it feels good.
Good day to be alive.
We didn't get the big storm we thought we would get here in Boulder Creek. So I got power.
Always useful on speaking days.
Yeah, speaking of, I have to make mention of Fast Eddie. I'm sorry, I really did, because he's been in contact. He's been calling Dominic on the phone. I don't know if you want to.
Sure. Yeah, let us know. How did his computer get rebuilt?
Dad told me, excuse me, I got an awful foot. He called me last night asking for the phone number to Newegg because he was going to order a new processor. He had no way of getting on the internet to do that. So, best as I know, he thinks it's a processor, so I gave him the phone number. And of course, their business hours are Monday through Friday, so we're probably not going to see it for several days because he'll order it on Monday, and things have to be shipped and stuff. So that's where we're looking at right there.
Well, all our best to him. He's one of our oldest and most steadfast community members. Maybe next year he should do a whole session so that he can feel like he's a part of this. I always keep one battered old PC around just in case this happens.
And I think he's going to as well in the future. And we're video. Yeah, I'm actually videoing a lot of this, catching it all on video, so we'll be able to at least get him some of the video files.
Well, I should probably get started because I know we have a big afternoon, but I thought maybe it'd be interesting for you guys to we could talk about several things, but there was an interest yesterday expressed in what digital space is doing in the rest of its existence. What do we do? Where do we come from, and what do we do? Does that sound interesting? Well, just to sort of sow the seeds, I starting in the mid 80s, I worked on graphical interfaces, some of the first ones that went on PCs. This is before Windows, or well, Windows 1 was out, but nobody really ever used it, or there's no applications for it. But I started out that way, and what I'll do is I'll pass Maxie URLs and stuff so that you can broadcast them. Does that make sense?
Sure. It does.
Okay, I passed her the first one, and that's kind of the master page. That's if you want to know what I quote unquote really look like, and stuff like that. Daimler.com is where everything is housed, and we'll start from there. It's going to be a little tour, just like the original web tours in virtual places. I can see why you guys want to integrate a web browser into Traveler. So if you look on that page, just down below, let me see what the link is. If you look at the link called the Star 8010 and the Birth of the Desktop Metaphor, that goes to my computer history pages, which represent the collection that I have here in the barn, which is about 600 or 700 vintage computers, and it also links to the page on Elixir, the Elixir desktop, which was the thing that I wrote in the mid-80s, which brought a Xerox-like graphical desktop to the net. There wasn't much net, but to it could run on an XT on an AT class machine with a high resolution screen. And basically, we converted a regular old DOS machine, which was command line and text, into a workstation-like environment with icons and a trash bin and windows and pull-downs and stuff. So if you click on that, you can sort of see the Elixir desktop and applications. And if you notice on the desktop, you know, people don't understand where all this comes from. In the 70s, Xerox assembled a dream team of people in Palo Alto, California, and created the Palo Alto Research Center, where they people sat around on beanbag chairs and rode their bicycles into the buildings. And it was kind of a neat thing because it was kind of a it was not like a regular corporate lab. It's not like Bell Labs. People could ride their bikes into the building, and they could work any hours they wanted. It was truly in the culture of the emergent Silicon Valley. And they conceived of a computer that would be personal, would be on a network, would allow you, you know, you'd have your own computer to have a graphical interface. You could do graphics on the screen. You could represent a page because Xerox liked documents. It's a document company. You could do everything. You could go have pixels on the page, go to pixels on a printer, one-to-one, and you could do graphics and music and email and central file stores, and it would be a social medium and everything. And they started working on the Alto computer in 73 and finished it and built it by hand. The memory to drive the screen cost $8,000 in 1973. But they knew that it would drop to like a penny a pixel by the mid-70s, and then by 1980 it would be affordable to buy the memory to drive a personal computer screen. And this, you're talking about 0 or 1. You're not talking about 8-bit color or 16-bit color. You're talking basic black and white. So in mid-70s, that was the world's most advanced computer. At the same time, they were making the Altairs, the hobbyists were meeting a mile or two away at Stanford, working on their Altair hobbyist computers, and they didn't have much connection with what Xerox was doing. But ironically, the Altair, which was to turn into things like the Macintosh or the Apple computer line because of the guys that met there, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, and then all the hobbyists and Bill Gates coming into town and selling the doing the basic for the Altair and everything at that homebrew computer club. And if you go to digibarn.com, it's somewhere down in there, there's homebrew newsletters. Was the coming birth of the computer that would take over from the Xerox vision and get graphical interfaces and a mouse and windows and icons and email and internet. But in the mid-70s, it was all working at Xerox PARC and at places that had Altos. And so what you're looking at in Traveler today, the great granddaddy of that, which they couldn't even have imagined doing something like Traveler in the mid-70s with the power, processor power they had. But the basic computer that you have in front of you is really very similar to the Alto. And we have an Alto in our collection. And so I was very interested as a kid in computers in the late 70s, but really when I went to college, they had a PDP-11, I think it was a 40, and I learned how to do BASIC, and the first thing I wanted to do was do graphics. But I had a terminal called a VT-101 terminal, and it could do basic block character graphics, but I made a little house layout system, a floor plan system in that, and they were impressed by that. We also had Teledon, which is a vector-based drawing paint system, teletext system. This is 1981. And so, but I saw in front of me, in 1981, there was a magazine, and on the cover was the Xerox Star. And they said, Xerox launches Star workstation. And Brillo, by the way, I keep hearing your keyboard going. I guess you're changing viewpoint. The Xerox Star, I looked at the thing, and it. I said, wait a minute, it has a full screen, black and white screen, but it has icons, a sea of icons on it, including a trash bin and all this stuff and windows coming up. And I realized, my goodness, you can address every pixel on that screen. Therefore, you can do anything. Now, this is 1981, long before the Macintosh, long before the Lisa. Most of the stuff had been only in park and at labs and just a few places. And then I really decided that computers were what I wanted to go into. And I said, you know what, by 1990, you'll probably have a tablet computer made by Fisher-Price, which a little kid could drop in the bathtub, and it would still work. And it would be sitting on the kitchen counter, and it would connect you with the world, and it would have a keyboard even built onto the tablet, and it would just do everything. It would help run your life. Of course, 1990 was a little premature for that, but I thought, this is going to be just packaged. It's going to be everywhere. These things are going to be everywhere. And it's a playground for the mind. When you can address pixels on the screen like this, you can do anything. And, of course, what we're seeing right here in Traveler is a result of that playground for the mind, a very fanciful, beautiful thing that I couldn't even have thought of in 1981. But in 1982, my brain was going at full tilt, and I was down at University of Victoria in something called the co-op program, where you go to school for 4 months and then you come out and work in a real company for 4 months, and you have to compete for those jobs with interviews. It's a wonderful program. It's all over the world. And so I was just before I went to my first job, I had this vision of a software that could show like moving vehicles on the moon. And that I always had a vision since when I was a kid. I used to study insects and ants, and I don't know who else did that here, but you look at how ants work and you try to figure out how do they communicate and how do they self-organize to do really an intelligent thing overall. Bees do the same thing. And so I thought that one day human beings would colonize the solar system. But to do that first, they will have to do it, basically create metallic robotic ants, vehicles that can go out and terraform or change the surface and make it ready for people. Because people are expensive and they're not that expendable, and people are fragile. They're very, very vulnerable. You know, you get a slight air pressure change and you're gone, and temperature change. We're very, very delicate beings. So I always thought that computers could serve the purpose of modeling the surface of the moon or an asteroid or something, and allowing you in advance to create vehicles virtually that then would travel out into space and be operated robotically and maybe even operate on their own to some degree, and you'd create the basis for humanity to explore. So you basically put our hands out there first, but in terms of a prosthesis, like a robot or an eyeball. And you know, if you look at the Mars exploration rovers today, that's really similar to, that's of course what they're doing. So looking at all this, I'm in 1982, looking at a computer screen and thinking, gee, with those pixels you can do a lot. Dreaming about modeling autonomous bots and stuff like that, maybe making strategy games. And so it was all sort of the formulation in my head. I was interested in space, I'm interested in a lot of things. And so from that point, I kind of went to graduate school at University of Southern California. I was very fortunate to be able to get in there, thanks to IBM. And then I came out and I got a job at a company called Elixir, and I was able to build what I saw on the cover of that magazine in 81. I made a version of the Xerox Star workstation desktop that ran on PCs, and Xerox marketed it all over the world. So a dream came true. That thing that I saw, I actually made a version of it for the company that invented the graphical interface. And the company was Elixir, but they, Xerox took marketed all the products. So it was incredible. But, you know, there was a kind of a down, the only downside for me is that, in a sense, I'd been in graphical interfaces, or GUIs sometimes called, or windows and icons, you know, there's all kinds of ways of describing it, for as long as anybody I knew, at least. And then by the early 90s, when you had Windows 3.0, which many of you remember, and all that stuff, and of course you had the Macintosh and Unixes, they all got the GUIs, I started getting really tired of it because it was all the same. And everybody was doing the same thing over and over again, and I didn't even think they were doing as good a job as Xerox had done in terms of the graphical look and feel. They had taken all the ideas, but the Mac was inferior, Windows was inferior, they're all inferior to the way that Xerox had done it in many ways. And so it was, you know, it was like, okay, everybody's got this thing, and now there's this thing called Mosaic, and which became Netscape, the browser. And I thought, well, here we go again. Now, people are discovering that you can schlep documents around the net and click on links and get another document. But for me, that was like, that's not cyberspace. That's not the vision of a connected digital space. That's something else. That's just a bunch of documents. And everyone was going gaga over it, and they thought it was the end-all and be-all. And for me, I found it very underwhelming. And the combination of a web page coming out, very useful, incredibly useful, but underwhelming. And for me, it was the promise of cyberspace was that it connected people. You know, you didn't have a network of anonymous computers with no users. You had people. And if you're visiting a web page, nobody knows you're on that page. And even though you're on someone's personal site, you're not contacting them. It's just this anonymous thing happening in the background. So everybody's just serving out pages and having no idea who's looking at what. And so for me, having read books like Snow Crash and Neuromancer, and you know, every time you would go to see a movie that Hollywood would depict cyberspace, even way back to the movie Tron. And if you remember Tron from 1980, 81, 82, I can't remember where it was, Tron, you know, showed a digital world with people in it. And so for me, you know, and I guess for a lot of writers and a lot of thinkers, cyberspace was going to be a human place. And as a result, I thought, you know, I'm just going to, it's 1993, I'm living in Prague in the Czech Republic, and I'm running a software lab for Elixir to port all our desktop metaphor stuff to Windows, which was barely able to carry it, but we did it. And I'm finishing up with this work. I've done this work for almost 10 years, and I want to get involved in this booming net cyberspace. And I'd been on the internet since the mid-80s, but it was mostly UUCP and Usenet and email. It wasn't what you would think of as the internet now. And I thought to myself, I'm going to jump straight into the net, but I'm not going to go and become yet another person promoting documents and the web, because I don't find it very interesting. And so I came back to the U.S., I bought a van, and I started traveling. And I said, I'm going to physically travel to all the people that I think I've heard about are working on this idea of a shared, visual, richly endowed cyberspace that represents people or bots or artificial life or whatever, but that it's a true cyberspace. And I went from SIGGRAPH in Orlando to Microsoft Research in Redmond to the Santa Fe Institute to talk to Chris Langton to the Bay Area. We called all the companies. We called Mosaic Communications. We talked to people that had just been formed, because that was Jim Clark forming what became Netscape. And just research and research and research. And then I said, you know, I'm going to get connected with Reed Reiner, this professor at Northern Arizona University, who had established a MUD, multi-user domain or dungeon, which is a text-based world that described a solar system in which individual schools and universities were colonies in this solar system. And it was all text, and I'd heard about this when I lived in Prague. But people vividly described Mars and the moon and planets and their lives and their politics and their economics in this quote-unquote game, which was a pedagogical or learning mud. I met him at Northern Arizona University and saw what it was like, and I thought, well, there's another piece of the puzzle. And so in 94, I decided I was going to locate in the Bay Area because I felt that that was within reach of a lot of the cultural and intellectual power around what might happen. And I chose the Santa Cruz Mountains, a town called Boulder Creek, which is where am I sitting now, and set up two organizations in 95, early 95. One was the Contact Consortium, which is a nonprofit established out of and as a daughter organization to Contact Cultures of the Imagination, which was established by Jim Fenaro, and who's an anthropologist, and a bunch of people in 1982, a lot of the intellectuals behind that were Gregory Bateson and Frank Herbert. So it's a very interesting organization. It's about hypothetical civilizations and anthropology for the future, and SETI is involved, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence is involved. Many of the modern science fiction writers you all know and love are involved in Contact COTI, Cultures of the Imagination. They have an annual conference in March. I went to the conference and proposed the Contact Consortium to Larry Niven and Jim Fenaro and Reed Reiner and all those people, and they said, yes, we'll support it. And so that organization was born. And I told a lot about that yesterday, how that grew. But another organization that I formed was a commercial company. And that was all about the same time, in August of 95. And the commercial company was called, and I went out for a long walk trying to come up with a name, and I came up with the name Digital Space. And I said, well, I better get down to my ISP and see if I can actually get that domain. And I did, and it was quite pleasantly surprised. I knew that I had to be able to get the domain name before I could choose the company name. So I established the company, and the company's mission was going to be, initially it was called Architects of the New Cyberspace. Oh, hold on. Yeah, somebody's sending me a text. And really what it was is really to be the architects of a cyberspace that is the one that we're in Traveler, like Traveler, but that it would come in and do commercial projects that a nonprofit couldn't do. And that the people who are involved in volunteering for the Contact Consortium, which were many, many, many people over the years, would come and eventually join the staff of Digital Space when the projects emerged. And I felt that the projects would emerge after a period where all the companies would try all the experiments, like there would be the Palace and Traveler and Active Worlds, and all these companies would come, and most of them went away, which is a little bit disturbing. But after several years of experimentation, it would settle down to actual really real work. And that's indeed what happened. So I got my second dream, which was, and this is by a long circuitous route, to model robots on the moon, because this is what we're doing now. Believe it or not, we are under contract. We have 6 or 7 parallel projects. So Digital Space really got going commercially in the year 1998. We did a project. 99, we did another project, very small ones. And then 2000, we did a very big project. And since the dot-com crash, we've had a continuous stream of projects that get, more fun and more diverse as time goes by. We're very fortunate because as thousands of companies were closing their doors, we were growing. And partly, I think it's, well, we didn't take any investment. We didn't get involved in all that venture speculation garbage that destroyed so many otherwise well-meaning people's lives, companies, whatever, some destroyed some stupid ideas too. But we didn't necessarily survive it. We just grew during the downturn. And largely today what we do is research and development contracts where you only have one customer. And that customer is a university or maybe a company or a government agency. In our federal government, you know, people may complain about it, but it does a lot of, you know, it spends our money unwisely and wisely sometimes, and it does a lot of great programs, research and development programs, National Institutes of Health, which is one division that we work with, and, of course, NASA. And luckily, over the hill, and locating in Boulder Creek was a lucky thing to do, because over the hill, and I'm sorry if I'm talking so long here, but is everybody hearing this?
Sure. Yes, sir.
I don't see any avatars that have died and are floating at the top of the pond like dead goldfish yet. So I'll just keep going, okay?
Thank you.
Anyway, so luckily, right over the hill from where we are is NASA Ames Research Center. That's the place which has the huge wind tunnels. That's the place where they developed the dynamics of the lifting body, which is for the space shuttle in the 70s. They developed a lot of stuff there. And that's where NASA has most of its human factors and software. They have a supercomputing center and everything. And in 99, I was presenting at a conference. I presented the Rusty Schweikart Walk on the Moon project, which I'll send Maxie the address for. Hold on. Okay, I just sent that through for her to broadcast. Now, this project was kind of a combination of digital space and the Contact Consortium and whatnot, but it was fascinating because what we did was we said, you know, we're experimentalists and designers in the theme of virtual worlds. You got it? And what we're going to do is we're going to see if you can create a historic reenactment with a real player, with a real person who was involved of an event on the anniversary of the event. And that event was Apollo landing on the moon, 1969. So in the summer, July 20th, 1999, and I knew, I met Pete Conrad, and Pete knew Neil Armstrong, but said that Neil Armstrong wouldn't come in online and do something like this. But Rusty Schweikart would, and Rusty Schweikart was on Apollo 9, and very, very cyber, very high-tech guy, also very great speaker. And I knew him. He and I had done a brainstorming for a new theme park, which was never built in Southern California. We'd been involved in a team to do that. But Rusty said, yeah, I'll do that. So I said, all right, download this thing called Active Worlds on your laptop, and he's up in Tiburon, and I trained him. And in a world that was a space world, it was Moonlander and a museum, all done by Ben Britton at the University of Cincinnati with a team. Beautiful world. They produced a CD. We worked with them to do this reenactment of the walk on the moon with Rusty Schweikart. And he came in on that day, and people met him, and he toured them around. He toured them out to the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, and talked about riding on the Saturn V, and it was incredible. It really was incredible. And during he was even messaging with people like Ed White, who were over in chat rooms on CNN, and Ed was saying, I don't know what's happening. It's all just chaos and text coming at me. And Rusty said, I'm in a space. And I'm sitting next to the LDAP, which is a piece of equipment on the moon, and I'm talking to people about the LAM, and it really is good. And so there's your difference between having a space like Traveler, and having nothing, just a text chat room, no context, no visual context. So anyway, a little girl walked up to Rusty in his avatar and said, "Mr. Schweikart, can I float myself up into the limb and come down the ladder just like you guys did?" And Rusty said, "Well, you should be able to. Polygon, there's no collision, so you should float right inside it, and you'll turn around and you'll see this circular thing, and that's a lamp that was above the hatch, and then you can just come out through the hatch." So she floated herself up into this virtual limb and went inside. It was all gray in there, and she came out the hatch, and she's looking down the ladder. We can all see her, and Rusty says, "Stop!" And she says, What's wrong?" And she said, "You got to come out backwards." She said, "Why?" I said, "Because the backpack on the lunar suit, on the Apollo suit for the surface, was too bulky. You couldn't come out the hatch front ways. You had to come out with your rear end first." And he said something funny. He said, "There's a reason why the cameras were not pointed at the hatch. They were pointed at the ladder, because we'd have like 2 billion people laughing as this rear end was trying to get out of the hatch." So that was something I had never heard before. So Lucy turned her avatar around and backed out, and then slid down and the ladder and touched the virtual surface. And then she turned around. It was interesting. It was all a bunch of avatars of people now wanted to do the same thing. So Rusty, being kind of organized as a person, said, "All right, if you all want to try this, you should go line up at the back of the limb and do it in an orderly way. Don't just all crush in there." And so they're all doing that. And he walks toward her to get people lined up. And he passes right through her. And, of course, you know, the avatars don't have collision like they do here in ActiWorlds, because I guess it's a different kind of environment, where if you had collision, it would be all chaos. Where here, if you didn't have a collision, it would be chaos. But she texted me, and she said, "My God, I've been touched by an Apollo astronaut. He touched me." I said, no, Julie, you know, his avatar just passed through your avatar, and, you know." And she said, "No, you're wrong. I have been touched. I can feel it in my body. I feel the shivers of contact. I've been touched by this man who is in history." And I said, "You know what? She's right. She's made contact. She feels connected with Rusty Schweikart in a personal way." And that the whole goal of the Contact Consortium and Digital Space, which was to experiment with how people make contact in cyberspace, was epitomized by this event that happened, and by what happened with that young girl. So, anyway, so that actually, that the goodness of that event, and I presented that at a conference on Virtual Worlds in 99, actually, or in 2000, or 99, because we were just about to do the event. And there's a guy in the audience named Martin Seerhaus, and he worked at NASA Ames, and he said, "Hey, this is great. We're trying to model Apollo 15. We have no graphical interface. We just have an agent model of what happened during Apollo 15. Will you come down and talk to us?" So I did. And that started a partnership with his group and a senior scientist named William Clancy that's lasted for all these years and has expanded to the point where we now have customers all over NASA and the subcontractor community of NASA. And I'm going to send you, well, actually, if you're at Digital Space, just go to the digitalspace.com homepage, and you can go under Projects and Showcase Selection. And I'll let people go there, and I'll just take a tiny break while you do that.